In China, extreme measures to combat COVID. In Beijing, keeping people involved with the upcoming Olympics far away from others.
Today, they announced they're going to be cordoning off the Olympic torch relay. And they even announced that if an Olympic vehicle gets into an accident, no one should stop to help out.
And wondering why it's been so hard to find a COVID test? The U.S. government ramped up investing in more tests months ago.
But actions that were taken in October and November are going to start having an impact in 6, 7, 8 months from now and not necessarily within 2 months.
And one unexpected impact from the underground volcano eruption in Tonga, giant ripples in the atmosphere far above the Earth's surface.
And I thought, that's really unusual. I've been looking at these data for probably 10 years. I've never seen anything like this.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Today in Geneva, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with his counterpart, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. It was a critical meeting as Russia continues to amass tens of thousands of troops near its border with Ukraine. Blinken reinforced the U.S. position.
If any Russian military forces move across Ukraine's border, that's a renewed invasion. It will be met with swift, severe, and a united response from the United States and our partners and allies.
To discuss the latest, we're joined by Miroslava Gongadze. She's the voice of America's Eastern Europe chief based in Kyiv, Ukraine's capital. Miroslava, there have been a lot of meetings between the U.S. and Russia about Ukraine over the past couple of weeks. How have Ukrainian officials reacted to these talks?
Obviously, they are very hopeful that these talks would bring some meaningful results, because obviously life of many, many millions of Ukrainians depend on it. In same time, they are assessing their capabilities to deter Russia. And President of Ukraine, after meeting with Mr. Blinken, came on TV and made a statement to Ukrainian people and telling them that there is nothing to fear. So it's very kind of hectic situation, but obviously they are dependent on Western support, Western community support, and other countries to guarantee the safety and independence of Ukraine.
You're in Kyiv right now. What's the atmosphere like there as Russia continues to exert military pressure?
Obviously, Ukrainians are worried about the situation. However, they have been living in this stress mood for a long time. Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014, and you can see many ads recently on TV and on the street that ask people to join military, to join local defense groups, to train themselves, and actually I would have many do. So people are trying to be prepared. In same time, there is plenty of fun here as well. People go to restaurants. People kind of get used to these threats. It's a very kind of interesting, hectic situation when some are worried and some say, whatever happened, happened. So this is how it feels here.
It's interesting, you know, we've all been following these talks between Russia and the U.S. Why haven't there been direct talks between Russia and Ukraine?
Unfortunately, it looks like Russia does not look at Ukrainian government as the government who can deliver results. And Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs Lavrov today at the press conference wanted to show that Ukrainian government and Ukrainian state is a failed state, and there is nothing to talk about Ukrainians, and they have to make decisions for Ukrainians with Americans. Americans are saying there is no decision about Ukraine without Ukraine. And that's a big difference in the position of both sides.
But there are people in Ukraine who have close ties with Russia in terms of language and culture. Are there any Ukrainians who support Russia's position in this standoff?
Yes, there are many. We have to admit that as well. However, they want to live in a low society and they have to have a good life. Recently, Ukrainians have a free visa zone in Europe. They can travel everywhere. They have a chance to make independent choices who they want to lead them. So all that is totally different from the country of the region, Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus, or others. So this is something that freedom Ukrainians are enjoying. And yes, some would say, yes, we love Russia. There's many of them However, they want to have independence and make their own choices.
My final question is, what would it mean for Ukraine and the rest of Europe if Russia were to again invade Ukraine?
That would be a total disaster. It would be total disaster for Ukraine, for Russia, and for Europe. And this is why it's so important to try to use any possible diplomatic or to find a way to peaceful resolution to this crisis.
Miroslava Gongadze is Voice of America's Eastern Europe chief based in Kyiv. She's been talking with us about the latest in the military tension between Russia and Ukraine. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Huge explosions in southwestern Ghana yesterday led to the deaths of at least 18 people and scores of injuries. Roads were shredded and a township was flattened. Rescue efforts are underway. The police are calling on nearby communities to open their doors to people who've lost their homes. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports on the latest from Ghana.
At the explosion scene is a visible trail of destruction. Dozens of dismembered dead bodies scattered all over. In this video recorded by a resident, a father is heard saying he can't find any of his children. Many people are believed to be still trapped in the rubble. At nearby hospitals in the western region, the nearly 60 people who survived the tragedy are battling for life. Massive explosions recorded again by residents flattened more than 500 buildings. Large plume of black smoke still billows above wrecked buildings and scattered debris. The community has been declared uninhabitable. According to a police report, the explosion occurred when a motorcycle veered off and went under a truck carrying explosives. The truck was en route to the Chirano gold mine, which is run by Canada-based Kinross. Kwame Odru, a resident in a nearby community, described the incident soon after it happened.
The driver of the vehicle upon reaching here collided with the motorcycle. After stepping out, the driver saw fire in his car and started telling people to run, but it was too late.
Deputy Lands and Natural Resources Minister George Murekuduka has provided further details.
The impact of the collision really got the vehicle and the explosives detonated, and that caused the nearby transformer also affected and also exploded.
The country's Bureau for Public Safety says there are more questions than answers. Nanayao Akwada is chief of party for the Bureau.
Definitely, we would have to go in there and investigate to find out where the explosives were coming from, whether they were moving these explosives in purpose-built vehicles sanctioned by the Ministry of Interior, whether the EPA guidelines were not violated, and for whether even the people who were transporting these explosives have the requisite training.
Ghana is one of Africa's largest gold producers. Several of the world's top gold mining firms operate here. But more than 35% of the country's gold is mined illegally, according to Ghana's finance ministry. The government has set up a committee to look into, among other things, whether the two mining companies followed due diligence before transporting the explosives. Friday morning, Vice President Dr. Mahmoud Baumia led a delegation to the explosion site.
We are here on behalf of the president and the government to see the extent of this very horrible disaster that has befallen us as a country.
Meanwhile, President Akufo-Addo extended his condolences to victims of the tragic incident while wishing the injured speedy recovery. For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Ghana.
We're just 2 weeks away from the start of the Beijing Olympics, and China is seeing a COVID outbreak in its capital city. The numbers, at least compared to those here in the U.S., sound really small. Today, Beijing officials announced 14 new cases in a city of more than 20 million people. That includes 3 confirmed cases of Omicron. But authorities are taking this very seriously. The World's China correspondent Rebecca Kanther is on the line from Shanghai. Rebecca, it's just 2 weeks from the Olympics. What's the feeling like?
Well, it's going to be a pretty quiet Olympics. The government announced that no tickets will be sold to the public. There are very few number of tickets going to be given out to sponsors and local companies. But people who attend will have to do 5 rounds of tests to be allowed into an event. And the government is doing everything it can to prevent people in Beijing from having any interaction with anyone involved in the games to prevent the spread of COVID. Today, they announced they're going to be cordoning off the Olympic torch relay. And they even announced that if an Olympic vehicle gets into an accident, no one should stop to help out.
Wow. So, Rebecca, what is the latest situation in China regarding COVID?
Well, the government is very worried about the Omicron numbers. Currently, there are 9 cities with cases. It's now completely normal to hear news of office buildings or shopping malls being forced to quarantine for up to 48 hours. This is from a video a shopper posted on China's version of TikTok last weekend. He and thousands of other shoppers in Shanghai were stuck inside a shopping mall for over 40 hours. He's showing himself going to brush his teeth, standing in line to get tested, looking at camping tents that have been set up in the walkways, and watching a movie at the theater. Meanwhile, in places like Xi'an, some people have been in quarantine lockdown in their homes for more than a month, and they tell me they expect the quarantine to continue until at least February.
That's amazing. I know yesterday we heard about a cull of 2,000 hamsters in Hong Kong. The government was afraid that imported hamsters that had tested positive for COVID could pass them on to humans. What are some of the other measures that government officials are taking to prevent COVID from spreading?
Cities all around China are taking drastic measures. Here's an example from Henan province in central China. This social media video shows these tiny little kids who are as young as 3, dressed in PPE protective gear that's way too big for them, and pulling little suitcases to go off in quarantine without their parents. The comments below the video are just heartbreaking. Everyone is saying, we just hope this virus can just go away. And there's also this big issue here right now about international mail. This is a Beijing CDC official warning people to take caution when dealing with international mail. The government says that at least 2 new cases of COVID could have been brought in through mail from abroad. Now, the science behind this is very murky, but the government is making a really big deal about mail from abroad being a potential source for coronavirus transmission.
The precautions are unbelievable. And on top of that, Chinese New Year is coming up too. And that's a huge national holiday in China when people travel home to see relatives. How is the pandemic impacting all that?
This year, many cities and companies are discouraging people from traveling like they did last year. Today, this video came out of a mayor of a small county in Henan province. He's warning people who want to return home to see their family for the new year that they will be quarantined. And if they still decide to come, he's going to quarantine them and then lock them up.
What about the public in China? What are you seeing in terms of their response to the government's emergency measures against COVID-19?
Well, people are still largely supportive of the government's zero COVID policy, but there is a lot of grumbling on social media. I think people are getting really tired of the tough restrictions. But at the same time, there are also these other videos that are being posted that are getting a lot of positive attention. This is a video posted by a woman who went on a blind date and ended up getting quarantined with the guy for a month. In this video, he's carrying flowers and they're announcing their engagement. There are several videos like this going around on social media of different couples.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thanks, Carol.
Rebecca Kanther has been speaking to us from Shanghai. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. In northeast Syria last night, ISIS militants staged a surprise attack on a prison. It happened in the Kurdish-controlled part of Syria. The prison houses suspected ISIS militants and is run by Kurdish-led forces allied with Washington. The U.S. said in a statement that it had provided air support to help those forces put down the attack. Still, at least 7 Kurdish fighters were reportedly killed, and 23 fighters with ISIS died. With us to discuss this is Charles Lister. He's a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute and director of its Syria program. Charles, what more can you tell us about this situation?
I mean, for me, this is the most significant and deadliest ISIS attack I've seen in Syria and Iraq since the fall of the territorial caliphate, which was nearly 3 years ago. So in and of itself, it's a major development. It's a clear indication that the threat from ISIS remains. But more than anything, it's a clear statement that our holding of thousands, at least 10,000 ISIS militants in makeshift prisons in northeastern Syria is an unsustainable situation. But this drew in US airstrikes, helicopters, drones. And as I say, this is the heaviest fighting we've seen in at least 2 to 3 years.
Can you tell us very briefly what we know about ISIS since former President Trump declared them defeated in 2018?
So they clearly don't control any territory, but, well, estimates vary, but there's certainly thousands of ISIS militants still active across parts of Syria and Iraq. They certainly have a fairly significant freedom of maneuver, given the fact that they are operating in small cells that are capable of concealing themselves during the day. They mostly operate at night. In fact, just in the last 24 hours, we also saw a significant attack in Iraq where an entire military base was assaulted by ISIS and over at least 11 Iraqi soldiers were killed. So the threat very much remains.
You said that keeping all these ISIS prisoners in these makeshift prisons may not be such a great idea. What's the alternative?
The vast majority of these prisoners are not Syrian or Iraqi. So one of the alternatives is for foreign governments to repatriate their citizens. The other option is to find a more local solution. For a period of time, some European countries were discussing with the Iraqi government the prospect of transferring their citizens to Iraqi custody, but there are all kinds of legal complications in that direction. And the other one, which is arguably an even worse option on the table than keeping them where they are, is to transfer them to the authority of the Syrian regime, a regime that has an extensive history of dealing with jihadists and using them for their own sort of regional foreign policy agenda.
How did so many ISIS militants end up in prisons like this?
To put it in very blunt terms, the United States and its various allies in Syria and Iraq and abroad couldn't kill everyone on the battlefield. And so inevitably, thousands were left having surrendered or being captured. And of course, therefore, we put them in various forms of detention until there was some kind of due process, of which there's been very little.
What are the U.S.'s options going forward in terms of protecting their allies and these sites where ISIS prisoners are being held?
Well, ultimately, the U.S. faces the big decision, which is how long we will remain in Syria. And of course, our presence there does help to an extent both give the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, the confidence to continue to sort of protect and secure and defend these prisons. It also bides more time for the international community to, I hope, come up with some kind of a more long-term and sustainable solution to this. So we have to figure out whether there is a judicial process that happens inside Syria, or whether we bite the bullet and accept the prospect of taking our citizens back.
Charles Lister is a senior fellow with the Middle East Institute and director of its Syria program. He joined us from Washington. Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
5 years ago, a handful of U.S. government employees at the American Embassy in Havana started feeling dizzy. They reported terrible headaches and ringing in their ears. Since then, about 1,000 episodes of this so-called Havana syndrome have been reported globally. This week, the interim findings of a CIA study made their way into the press. The big takeaway, it's unlikely that whatever has been making U.S. employees sick is a campaign by Russia or any other foreign actors. Joining me now to discuss this is David Relman. He's a microbiologist at Stanford University who studied Havana syndrome. Dr. Relman, do you agree with the interim findings of the CIA task force report that of the 1,000 or so episodes, there's only a few dozen cases of Havana syndrome that can't be explained and that need to be investigated further?
I want to frame my comments based on the work that I did together with a committee at the National Academies of Science. We focused on cases that were the least easily explained by known medical or environmental conditions. These cases are where we found a basis for pulsed radio frequency energy as the most plausible mechanism among those that we considered.
What is pulse radio energy?
Microwave or radio frequency energy is one part of what's called the electromagnetic spectrum. There are lots of forms of it in the world around us. It includes continuous waves like you see in your microwave oven, but there are also pulsed forms, for example, in cell phones or in medical applications or in radar. And even these pulsed forms can vary a lot, but certainly one should not expect the same mechanism to explain all cases.
So theoretically, what would expose them?
If, in some of the cases, the causal mechanism is something like pulsed radio frequency energy, then we have to look very carefully at how this form of energy might be delivered in a directed fashion. But this is something that is known to be possible with high energy, very brief pulses of microwave energy. Where would this come from? You'd have to start thinking, are there those in the world who are deliberately producing it for some reason? You'd have to think that perhaps there are people who are exploiting it using devices that are involved in communications or other ways of manipulating electronic systems, and that these devices are somehow responsible. Pulsed radio frequency energy is a technology that has proliferated, you know, widely around the globe. It's not owned by anyone, and instead is potentially available to many. So you have to think about the possibility of multiple different actors as one potential scenario.
What kind of research still needs to be done to be more certain of what's causing these U.S. employees to experience these symptoms and where it came from?
During our study at the National Academies, we identified a number of major gaps in our understanding that would help, I think, immensely in understanding what's going on here. One of those areas is the dearth of information about what are the biological effects of these very distinct, perhaps unusual forms of electromagnetic energy. You know, how do, for example, radio frequency energy or microwave energy, how does it interact with humans or human cells? It's something that we here in the United States have not devoted much attention to. Others have, but there's still a paucity of good understanding of mechanism. And that's something that we really need to, I think, focus on for a whole variety of reasons, not just these cases, but to understand how we as humans are going to fare in a world that's increasingly dominated by electronics and electromagnetic waves. That's the world we live in.
David Relman is a microbiologist at Stanford University who has studied Havana syndrome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Absolutely. I'm happy to.
Still ahead, we remember a Brazilian music icon who brought us the sounds of the samba to try to help make a better world. And you're listening to The World. In Turkey, busloads of tourists come to watch the whirling dervishes. Some who partake in this form of meditation say the centuries-old practice should be kept private.
So yeah, to have it done for money, to turn it into dance and art, it's not preferred. It's not preferred.
A clash between traditionalism and commercialism in Turkey, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The volcanic blast in Tonga last Saturday took just minutes, but the emergency response has taken days, and it's only just begun. While the Red Cross had supplies already pre-positioned on Tonga's main island, aid from the outside world started arriving only yesterday. It took until then to clear the airport runway of volcanic ash. A huge cargo plane from New Zealand brought water, shelter kits, generators, and communications equipment. Other flights were sent back.
An Australian flight carrying supplies has been forced to return to base, though, after a positive COVID case was found on board.
Keeping Tonga COVID-free is a top priority for all aid missions. The island nation has reported only one case since the pandemic began. Today, the first ship arrived, also from New Zealand, with water and an onboard desalination plant. Other nations, including the U.S., Japan, and China, have their own aid missions in progress. The internet connection to Tonga was also cut when the blast tore through an undersea cable. A fix may take weeks to complete. The volcanic eruption in Tonga had another impact, one that has scientists looking at measurements in disbelief. The blast created some of the most extraordinary atmospheric shockwaves ever detected. Those are giant ripples in the air, some 60 miles above the Earth. Corwin Wright is an atmospheric physicist at the University of Bath in England. Corwin, how high up were these shockwaves detected?
Very high. We have measurements in several different parts of the atmosphere. We can see them distinctly in all sorts of different height levels, going as far as over 100 kilometers or 60 miles.
And how fast did they move? I mean, at the time of the blast, did they shoot right up there, or have they been making their way up there?
It's sort of a combination of them, because there's lots of different kinds of waves being emitted. So there's that first shock wave that we may have sort of seen in animations on the web that goes out at the speed of sound, and that's obviously very fast. But then there's other kinds of waves that follow a bit slower. And in particular, we study a kind of wave called gravity waves that follow it at maybe sort of 10% less than the speed of sound.
What are shock waves?
The sort of classical ones are basically a great big angry sound wave that just goes really fast. The gravity waves are a bit more complicated. So what they are due to air being displaced, then its weight pulls it down, but then its buoyancy pulls it up in the same way that if you push a duck down in a bath, it will bounce up again. It's that effect.
Have you ever seen anything like this occur after a volcanic eruption?
No, we haven't. That's the interesting thing. We have measurements of this type going back about 20 years or so, and colleagues have looked for the signals of volcanoes in these data, and they've seen much smaller signals for anything on this scale and definitely covering the whole Earth. It's certainly unique in our instrument record so far.
What are the implications of this? I mean, what is the meaning of these shockwaves?
That's a bit tricky to work out, and I think we need to sort of look for a few weeks. When we study these waves normally, we're interested in their effect on sort of weather systems and climate. So whether this has sort of a big effect of slamming into these weather systems, that's a bit harder to work out, and we're looking at that at the moment.
I mean, you're a scientist who pays attention to this stuff. At what point did you realize that something extraordinary was happening with this volcano from an atmospheric perspective?
Pretty much immediately, actually. So I'd say within a few hours. I'm fairly active on Twitter, and a colleague of mine sent a post saying, I've seen an exciting volcanic eruption. Is there any gravity waves coming off this? So I looked at sort of the near real-time data, and right away after the volcano, I probably looked sort of 7 or 8 hours after it happened, and you could see in the data these waves half a world away from it. And I thought, that's really unusual. I've been looking at these data for probably 10 years. I've never seen anything like this.
I'm curious what kind of questions you and your colleagues are asking now. I mean, now that you've seen these things, what do you want to know?
Partly, we're using it sort of a natural experiment to tell us about how these waves work. We often look at these waves as a slow-scale driver of climate and weather, but it's usually quite hard to work out the effects of an individual process because you have sort of little things going away all the time and a big sort of sudden shock like this. It's quite unusual and doesn't happen very often. So it's a very nice experiment of telling us how this kind of thing affects the atmosphere normally.
Why do you think this particular volcano created these waves? I mean, what's special about it?
That's one of the things we're trying to work out. Our current working theory, and this may change obviously, is that because it was underwater, that changed the physics of what was happening. So whereas normally you get a load of solid material going up, in this case it may have been sort of more steam, and that may have had more of a sort of convective effect. That's sort of our current working guess of why it's different.
What's been your reaction to this volcano and its possible implications for your field?
It's sufficiently exciting that I've sort of dropped what I was working on currently to work on this full time for the next couple of weeks, which is unusual because I manage a research group, so that's quite hard for me to do usually. So I think we can get a lot of quite interesting physics out of this quite fast because of sort of the unique nature of the event, which could be very interesting and useful to our broader research programs into how the atmosphere works.
Corwin Wright is an atmospheric physicist at the University of Bath in England. Thanks, Corwin.
Thank you very much.
State Department officials traveled to Sudan this week. They condemned the use of disproportionate force against protesters there and expressed deep concern about the disruption of the country's democratic transition. More than 70 people have been killed in Sudan since the military took control back in October. Some of that violence has been captured on videos. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi spoke with one person hoping to use that evidence to hold people accountable.
Week after week, for nearly 3 months, Sudan's capital Khartoum has seen massive protests. People in the thousands gather to demand that the military hand control of the government back to civilian leaders. This week, at least 7 protesters were killed by live ammunition. Activists blame Sudan's security forces, including the army and a paramilitary group. And they say they have the evidence to back that up.
We saw how they shoot directly towards the crowd, how they shoot directly live ammunition. We saw very many people got injured and killed.
Munim Adam is a Sudanese human rights lawyer who manages the Sudanese Archive. That's a growing collection of videos and photos documenting human rights abuses since Sudan's revolution in 2018. Adam says most of them come from social media.
Mainly we collect data from Facebook because people in Sudan, they use extensively Facebook, Twitter, they use Instagram.
He says they also pull videos from WhatsApp and even TikTok. The Sudanese Archive has collected more than 3,000 pieces of photo and video evidence since the October coup alone. Some show snipers shooting live ammunition from rooftops, tear gas canisters fired directly at protesters. Adam says the video evidence is also used to track license plates in order to follow the movements of security forces. These details all add up and paint a damning picture.
This actually just showed during this period of time how all these forces collaborate and they intended to commit all these crimes that we've been seeing since 2018 until today.
The violence is intentional, he says, and well planned. Sudanese military leaders, including those behind the coup, deny this. They've also promised to investigate the deaths of protesters. But Adam says the aim of the archive is to find the truth.
I really hope the time will come when this data we collected and other evidence as well, so everybody committed any crimes or violations against civilians, they will face justice, including those who are like wanted by the International Criminal Court.
Meanwhile, protesters in Sudan are not giving up, despite the dangers they face in the streets. On my recent trip to Khartoum, I recorded some videos at a protest as security forces shot tear gas projectiles at demonstrators. It didn't take long for an armed man in plain clothes to show up and tell people to stop filming. The risks of being detained or worse at these protests are real, but that hasn't deterred thousands of people from demonstrating. At one hospital in Khartoum, I meet 15-year-old Ahmed Abdullah Ahmed Idris. He doesn't look straight at me. Instead, his eyes struggle to trace the shadows passing by. Outside, I meet his father, sitting on a large rug. He offered me water and sweets and told me how his son was injured. His son was hit by a tear gas canister, he said. His vision has now been damaged. He shows me the battered and charred Sudanese flag that he was wearing around his neck during that protest. After the boy was injured, his father says security forces beat him. Idris tells me the time is up for the military. What they did to his son was inhumane. Like many Sudanese, he doesn't want the military in control. Munim Adam from the video archive agrees. Last month, he testified on Capitol Hill, talked about human rights violations, and asked for the U.S. to help hold those accountable.
The main hope from that is to establish the targeted sanctions.
Sanctions against Sudan's military leaders. This week, U.S. diplomats who traveled to Khartoum called for investigations into the deaths and injuries of protesters. They said the Biden administration would consider measures against those preventing the reestablishment of a civilian-led government, but they did not specify what those measures might be. More big demonstrations are planned for Monday. For The World, I'm Halima Kakandi in Nairobi.
Have you signed up yet to receive your free at-home COVID testing kit? This week, the Biden administration began allowing each household in the U.S. to order up to 4 tests. They've been hard to come by, both here in the U.S. and abroad. It's a problem that Prashant Yadav has studied. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington. My colleague Marco Werman recently caught up with him.
Let's rewind a bit to the start of the pandemic. The U.S. government, as some of us will recall, mismanaged the supply of COVID tests really early on. Remind us what happened.
So early in the pandemic, our efforts were focused on PCR testing. And there were a series of bottlenecks, such as not having sufficient swabs, not having sufficient reagents. And the government systematically overcome those bottlenecks by making investments to the component and spare part suppliers and so on. But now we are seeing a demand surge for rapid antigen tests. And here, the supply chain has a different set of challenges.
So what did other countries do and do better than Washington in 2020?
So some countries started using rapid antigen tests early on. They started giving out contracts to suppliers. They registered a larger number of rapid antigen tests in their countries through emergency use authorizations early on. This included rapid antigen test suppliers from Korea, from China, from countries around the world. So that had an expanded set of supply on one side, and on the other side, they created demand by the government purchasing sufficient quantities of tests.
So it sounds like what you're saying, Prashant, is that those other countries' order tests created a market for manufacturers, and we didn't really do that here. Did we have the government support and will to do that?
So the government in the U.S., starting October and November of 2021, started investing through, you know, specific contracts and other kinds of investment instruments to expand manufacturing capacity for rapid tests. But actions that were taken in October, November are going to start having an impact in 6, 7, 8 months from now and not necessarily within 2 months. So I think we've done many of the right actions, but they've probably been done with a delay of many months. And as a result, we are in a situation where the demand has far outstripped supply. And all actors in the supply chain are trying their best to scale up capacity, but it just takes more time.
But why did Europe and other parts of the world embrace these tests so much earlier?
I think they had a multi-pronged testing strategy where they were thinking about PCR for precise testing, but also more frequent testing using rapid antigen tests. And they had started investing and buying them earlier and sooner than we did here in the U.S. Not to say that other countries have sufficient supply. I think right now we're in a situation where all of them are impacted because the total supply in the market is weaker. But at the same time, I think if we make systematic investments to enhance supply chain capacity, it will not only create sufficient supply for us in the U.S., it will also increase the global supply.
Prashant, we've been talking about in-home testing. Then there are the PCR tests where you go to a clinic or a doctor's office to get tested. We're also seeing a lot of backlogs there. Why is that?
So the capacity for PCR testing essentially depends upon, you know, staff and equipment. And I think there's been sufficient ramp up of both staff and equipment for PCR testing. But at the same time, the sudden surge in demand due to the new variant is something that our current capacity cannot meet. That's what is creating the backlogs. I don't think we can go and install new machines and hire new lab technicians overnight because, you know, once this demand surge for PCR testing comes down, that capacity will then be underutilized. So I think somehow we have to manage through a period of a few weeks for PCR testing by either using better sequencing methods, prioritizing some test results to come out quicker, but more importantly, use PCR testing in conjunction with rapid testing and then managing those two supply sources, not as separate, but as jointly thinking about them.
So in addition to that, what else needs to happen moving forward?
We need to think about testing capacity of all types, rapid, at-home, PCR, as an investment in preparedness. We need to think as a country, how much excess capacity in testing should we be willing to invest in, fully acknowledging that not all of that may be utilized when things are going well, but that capacity needs to be available when things are not going well. And that would certainly require large investments from the federal government above and beyond what has already happened, not just in terms of purchasing more tests, but also systematic investments to resolve bottlenecks in the testing supply chain.
That was Prashant Yadav, a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, speaking with the world's Marco Werman. Singer Elsa Suarez was born in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro in 1930. Her spirit remained connected to Rio for her entire life. She died yesterday in the city of her birth. Elsa's life was framed by struggle. Her music was a source of healing. This is from Elsa Suarez's second album, released in 1961. Caso você chegasse no meu chateau e encontrasse aquela mulher que você gostou. She was in her 30s, but had already seen more in her life than most people twice her age. Her father was a bricklayer who played samba guitar. He married off his daughter Elsa when she was just 12. 9 years later, she was a single parent with 5 children. Elsa's initial recording contract fell apart when RCA found out she was black. but it didn't stop her from pushing the limits of a sound that was already popular around the world, samba. Maybe it was her friendship with Louis Armstrong who inspired Elza Suarez to work scat improvisation into samba. This musical joy, though, was perforated by personal troubles. Elza Suarez married a Brazilian soccer star, a tumultuous marriage that ended with him battling alcoholism and beating Elza regularly. After he died of cirrhosis in 1983, followed by the death of their son in a car accident, it took some years, but Elza Suarez eventually got her musical life back on track, as she told the French newspaper Le Monde Diplomatique in 2018.
E gostaria de ter mais Elzas buscando isso também, mais cantores.
She said, I wish in Brazil there were more Elzas singing, even screaming. We all want a better life, a better world. She continued, they say a good country is one with good music. Let's make great countries with great music. One of her final recordings was a song that found her in a reflective mood. The video shows her in glamorous, sparkling makeup in a costume that looks ready for carnival. But it's deceptive. The song's title translates as Woman at the End of the World.
Meu choro não é nada além de carnaval, é lágrima de samba na ponta dos pés. A multidão avança como um vendaval, me joga na avenida que não sei qual é.
Brazil's Elza Suarez, the woman at the end of the world. She was 91.
Beija minha mão, as asas de anjo soltas pelo chão, na chuva de confetti.
More than 700 years ago, a religious scholar started spinning. The poet and Sufi mystic Rumi was moved by the clanging sound of goldsmiths hammering in what is now the Turkish city of Konya. Spinning in place became a form of meditation and prayer, now known as the Sema. Rumi's followers continued the practice, passing the tradition down for centuries, even through a government ban in the 1920s. Today, those who partake are known as whirling dervishes. But as the world's Duri Bhaskaran reports, it's an often misunderstood practice, torn between commercialism and tradition, even in the city of Konya, where it all started.
The spectators are seated around a circular wooden stage. A single beam of light shines down on a man who places a red sheepskin cloth on the floor. There is a procession of semazens, those who practice the Sema. They wear tall felt headpieces and long white robes, covered by a brown outer cloak. They are all men. Women are forbidden from doing the Sema before a mixed gender audience. A type of flute, known as the ney, symbolizes the breath of God, blowing life into human forms. Standing shoulder to shoulder, the semazens kneel. The semazens smack the ground with their hands, and the sema begins. They shed the outer layer, an act that symbolizes shedding their egos. They bow, and they begin to spin. It's a slow, controlled spin. One foot stays planted on the floor. At times, one hand reaches up to the sky while the other points downward, a position meant to bring love from God down to earth and its people. It's hypnotic. The movement, the swishing of the feet, the smell of incense. Many of the semazens have a look of peace on their face, eyes half open, head leaning back, as if they're meditating. After the ceremony, one of the semazens, Osman Sarier, changes into a brown sweater and jeans and puts his hair in a loose bun.
İşitip cezbe gelmek, yani heyecanlanmak, coşkuya gelip Allah'ı anmak.
He says the Sema ceremony is meant to represent the other world, the whirling, an act of remembering God, to listen and to remember.
Semazenlik yapıyorum burada, aynı zamanda turizm rehberliği yapıyorum. Burası İrfan Medeniyeti Araştırma Kültür Merkezi.
Outside the ritual, he explains, most semazens live normal lives. They get married, have kids, work desk jobs. Sarıyer himself works as a guide at the center where the ceremony took place.
Bütün dinlere ve Hazreti Mevlana'nın da görüşlerine göre.
Doing the Sema for tourists is a way to share this ritual. He says anyone, no matter their faith, can feel the energy in this room and get something out of it. But not all semazens believe in sharing the ritual so widely. In 2008, UNESCO inscribed the Sema as one of the masterpieces of the oral and intangible heritage of humanity. Konya today is a place of pilgrimage for many Muslims and people of other faiths. They come to visit an elaborate tomb where the 13th century religious philosopher Rumi is buried. This mausoleum is crowned by a tower of sky blue tile. In December, hotels in the city are sold out for weeks as people come from all over to pay their respects. And in this hubbub, where buses full of tourists arrive to buy tickets to see the whirling dervishes and flock to the shops where tiny figures of Semazens can be bought as souvenirs, it can start to feel a bit, well, commercial.
When we do Sema in public, it's a demonstration. Sema is really a very private thing.
Ismail Fenter is originally from California, a man who grew up Catholic, moved to Konya, and converted to Islam. He regularly does the Sema in the Rose Garden of the International Mevlana Foundation, which is just steps away from Rumi's tomb. It's a free demonstration, and that's how Fenter believes it should be.
So yeah, to have it done for money, to turn it into dance and art, I mean, from the true Mevlevi perspective, and I'm speaking only for myself, it's not preferred. It's not preferred.
Sometimes Semazens get around this rule by accepting donations for their group after a demonstration. But others remain in seclusion, believing that this is the purest form of the ritual. I meet Adnan Kachuk at a cafe in central Konya. He brings his wife and teenage daughter. By day, he's a manager at a construction firm, but he's also a Semazen. He says historically, Semazens were organized in dervish orders throughout the Ottoman Empire and beyond. The orders were banned in 1925 as Turkey was becoming a secular republic, so they went underground. By the 1990s, when Kachuk was a teenager, there were very few young Semazens in Konya. But one day, a Polish official called Konya's tourism office to ask if they had any whirling dervishes they could send to participate in a youth festival. Kuchuk says that he and his friends were recruited for a crash course in how to be a Semazen, practicing to turn themselves around on a mat that was just 10 feet square. They got the robes, flew to Poland, and it was a success. He started doing the ritual publicly. But as it became more popular, as people hired the Semazens for weddings, tour groups, even shopping malls, the ritual turned sour. They'd take us to a hotel, people would be eating, and as we're preparing the Sema, they're serving alcohol, he says, which completely contradicts the ritual of a Sema. Today, Kachuk gathers with a small group of friends to do the Sema privately. Before the pandemic, they did it once a week. According to tradition, the organization can have no bank account, no political affiliation, no excluding people from any segment of society, no doing the Sema for any reason other than dedication to your God. In modern society, our minds are already so busy with worldly matters, Kachuk says. There needs to be a place that's cleansed of all that. These places give you room to breathe. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin in Konya.
Derry also captured some images of the whirling dervishes with their tall hats and flowing white robes. You can see the Semazen in action for yourself. Just head over to our Instagram feed, theworld.org/Instagram. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you back here on Monday.